Thank you. Thank you very much. Just want to say thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here and really looking forward to sharing with you some of the cancer modeling work that we're doing. As you mentioned, we're at the Center for Applied Proteomics and Molecular Medicine at George Mason University in Manassas, Virginia. And we're a very interdisciplinary group, lots of different scientists working there. We tend to have a very translational focus, but we do a lot of basic science research as well. I myself am an applied mathematician, so I'm interested in working with other scientists to come up with theoretical paradigms, I guess, for better understanding diseases of signal dysregulation, and cancer is obviously one of them. So I'm going to be talking about our cancer modeling today, particularly focusing on the therapy side of things, and focusing especially on the use of a lot of the newer drugs, so-called targeted inhibitors, which actually modulate the activities of the proteins in the cell signaling network. Okay, so I'm going to approach this by first of all just giving a little bit of background about some of the challenges that we're facing in treating cancer. And I'm going to segue into a new conceptual framework that we're working on, which focuses not so much on the complexity itself of cell signaling, but looks more at the mechanisms that the cell uses to regulate its behavior. And these, of course, are the mechanisms that are dysregulated in disease. And then based on this concept, I'm going to show you some modeling we've done, particularly on the mTOR pathway, to show you some of the ideas we're working with. So just in terms of background, I know a lot of these statistics will be familiar to many of you, but I just want to highlight some of the challenges that we're facing today in the so-called war on cancer. And of course, these are American statistics, but trends across the world, the Western world, are broadly similar. So the ACS, the American Cancer Society, estimates that this year over 500,000 people will die of cancer in the United States. So that amounts to over 1,500 Americans succumbing to the disease per day. It's rather a lot. In addition, cancer currently accounts for nearly a quarter of deaths in the United States, exceeded narrowly only by heart disease. And in fact, cancer is now beginning to overtake heart disease as the number one killer in many sectors. Now, while death rates for other chronic diseases, such as heart diseases, cerebrovascular diseases, influenza, pneumonia, and so on, have diminished significantly, cancer death rates have remained about the same today since 1971, when President Nixon declared the war on cancer. So this is really very disappointing, and clearly, on some level, we're losing the war on cancer. So if that were not perplexing enough, what's disturbing is the amount of resources that have been devoted to cancer, with over $200 billion of public and private investment in basic and clinical cancer research in the United States since that time. And from a drug development point of view, in the pharmaceutical industry, of which oncology is a major sector, R&D spending now exceeds $50 billion annually, which is up more than 147% since 1993. Now, meanwhile, drug approval applications to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration have only increased 38% over that time frame, so it's not keeping pace at all with the resources that are being devoted to this. And moreover, trends in approval rates for drugs against new targets, and by new targets, I mean cellular molecules that have not been perturbed by previous drugs, are even more disappointing, with an average of only 2 to 3 such innovative agents coming from the entire industry every year for the past decade. So it's certainly not for want of input in terms of money that we're facing this stalemate in cancer treatment. Now, beyond the economic side of things, there have also been a number of important technological advances which should, in principle, have enabled us to make better progress. And in the fields of genomics and proteomics in particular, we now have all manner of high-throughput and sensitive data acquisition and molecular profiling technologies, all kinds of gene arrays and protein arrays, which give us a lot of information, a lot of data on the disease state. And this in tandem with advances in high-performance computing and so on have transformed biology, and molecular biology in particular, into a very data-rich science. So we have more information than ever now on the molecular details of a particular disease. In addition, we now have new and better technologies to create, screen, and test and evaluate targeted chemical compounds that selectively modulate the proteins themselves in the cell signaling network. So, in principle, with such impressive advances in cell and tissue analysis and the ability to continually expand our repertoire of available pharmacopoeia, we should, in principle, have the ability now to treat cancer with an efficacy hitherto unimagined. On the other hand, despite the generally gloomy outlook in cancer treatment as a whole, there have been a few outstanding successes which point to the very real potential for a major revolution in cancer treatment, particularly in the field of molecular targeted therapeutics. And two of the foremost of these examples are the use of Gleevec to treat chronic myelogenous leukemia and the use of gefitinib or Iressa to treat non-small cell lung cancer. Both of these are clinical examples of a phenomenon that's often referred to now as oncogene addiction, where multiple molecular derangements or mutations, let's say, are required to precipitate a malignant phenotype. Nevertheless, in many cases, the tumors appear to become dependent upon or addicted to, in a sense, just one of these mutant oncoproteins. So in the case of CML, in many cases, the tumor cells become strictly dependent upon the mutant BCR-ABL oncoprotein, and so therefore do not survive well in the presence of the ABL kinase inhibitor, Gleevec. Similarly, in non-small lung cancer, a number of key somatic mutations in the epidermal growth factor receptor have been identified, which predispose these cells to apoptosis in the presence of the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, gefitinib. In both of these cases, however, even though they're very successful generally, tumor recurrence is still a problem. But intriguingly, what we find is that the vast majority of relapses typically involve secondary mutations, resistance mutations, in the actual target kinase itself. So this is very encouraging, actually, because it suggests that room for evolutionary maneuver is actually extremely constrained even in the face of genomic instability. And this, in turn, increases the likelihood that we're going to be able to combat this problem of tumor recurrence with combination therapy, which is something I'll talk about a little later. In any event, in the field of cancer treatment generally, we do appear to have arrived at something of a stalemate. And so apparently there's a need for us to come up with some fresh approaches at a fairly fundamental conceptual level. So the concept, a few years ago, we began working on this subject and we began to publish a series of papers in which we outline what we feel is a conceptual missing link in this field, which we feel can really offer some promise. And the concept we came up with is summarized by the first in this series of papers in which we describe the wiring or the functional architecture of cellular signaling networks as having a simple complexity which enables the cell to exhibit a sensitive robustness. So the concept here is as follows. Cell signal transduction networks are obviously extremely complex. First of all, in terms of the sheer numbers of proteins that are potentially involved, the numbers of different types of interactions, what kind of binding interactions, enzymatic modifications, phosphorylation, protein cleavage, all kinds of things. And these interactions form pathways which can relay signals across multiple distinct subcellular compartments. And the pathways themselves tend to be very interconnected and evolve all manner of complicating features such as scaffolds, feedback loops, and so on. So it's really a very complex system. And it's partly this complexity which renders a cell such a versatile and sophisticated organism, able to generate a wide variety of responses to a wide variety of possible stimuli. However, when you think about what the cell has to achieve through its cell signaling network, how it uses these biochemical signals to make sense of the information it's receiving, it's not enough to just say it's complex. On some level, these networks must be overarchingly simple in the sense that these protein networks have to be able to work together to orchestrate well-defined and mathematically tractable mechanisms. For example, if the cell has to undergo a point of no return decision, like apoptosis or progression through cell cycle checkpoints, then overarching the number of protein interactions involved must be a well-defined mechanism to generate a one-way switch. So this is a sense of simplicity within complexity, paradox of cell signaling. But probably one of the most remarkable aspects of cell signaling is its amazing ability to be at once robust to unwanted perturbations while at the same time being able to respond specifically and sensitively to relevant inputs. So the cell can choose to respond decisively and at the same time filter out signaling noise and resist harmful assaults. So ultimately, the quote-unquote intelligent functioning of the cell is evoked at the intersection of these two key paradoxes. So I'm going to show you now the use of these simple complexity kind of outlooks on the cell. I'm going to talk about a couple of mathematical models we put together to demonstrate this. Most of the models I'm going to show you we published late last year in this article in Nature Reviews Drug Discovery. The first model I'm going to take you through, the main model of my talk actually, focuses on the mTOR pathway, the mammalian target of rapamycin pathway. And this is obviously of interest here because mTOR signaling is frequently dysregulated in many cancers. So, now, IRF1, insulin receptor substrate 1, is a key regulatory hub in the mTOR pathway because it's able to be, it contains a whole constellation of phosphorylation sites which enable its activity to be regulated both positively and negatively. So I'm just going to run through the basic architecture of this signaling network to place the later models in context. So IRF1 can be activated by many different growth factor receptors, the main one being insulin receptor and insulin-like growth factor receptors. And they activate IRS1 by tyrosine phosphorylation. So activated IRS1 then goes on to ultimately activate PI3 kinase, which is a lipid kinase, which goes on to recruit PDK1 and AKT to the signaling to the plasma membrane, where AKT is phosphorylated by, activated, I should say, by PDK1-mediated phosphorylation. Now, AKT is a very important pro-survival protein in a cell, and this forms the base protein in this motif because it can regulate IRS1 both positively and negatively. Positively through its direct interaction with IRS1, where it phosphorylates it on as yet unknown amino acid residues, and negatively via a whole cascade of events via mTOR and its downstream effect of P70S6 kinase, which ultimately phosphorylates IRS1 on various key serine residues, thereby down-regulating its activity. So here you can see we have two different kinds of feedback loops generated ultimately from AKT. And this is a very important signaling motif in the cell because of this dual regulation. Now, in modeling this, the rationale has been to focus on these overarching mechanisms themselves and leave out as much molecular detail as we can. So the main features of the model are, of course, the balancing act of IRS1 activity. It's regulated, as I say, both positively and negatively, ultimately by AKT. And then here we have the famous Gold-Beta-Postlund equation governing AKT activation. And the main significance of this Gold-Beta-Postlund equation here is it generates a very strong nonlinearity coming down through the main axis of the cascade. So before I show you the use of this model to discuss different therapeutic approaches, I first want to say a couple of things about the general behavior of this model in different parameter regimes. So I'm looking here at two different scenarios. One which we might consider representative of a normal signaling network, and one which might be more reflective of a tumor signaling network. So here, as you can see, if we have the positive and negative feedback loops in a balance, then we have a very nice controlled graded response to the stimulus. On the other hand, if the positive feedback loop dominates too much, then we can get this bistable switch. So what happens is if we start here at low stimulus levels, we have a nice increase in the activity of the apex molecule, which here is IRS1. But as we reach a critical stimulus strength, then the solution jumps discontinuously to this elevated monostable steady state. Now, I've chosen the parameters here to place the hypothetical boundary, left-hand boundary, of this bistable region beyond the zero stimulus level. So in fact, what we have is a one-way switch, and what that means is once we've tripped this switch and we're at this elevated signaling level, then in fact we will remain at this high level even with a complete withdrawal of the stimulus. So by this mechanism, signaling molecules can easily become constitutively active. And this model is significant in this context because in actual fact, alterations in the delicate balance of feedback loops converging at IRS1 are indeed thought to underlie its frequently observed constitutively active levels in many human tumors. So I want to use this model now to illustrate the importance of understanding overarching mechanisms in the cell. So I'm going to look at four distinct classes of therapy suggested by this motif. We're going to inhibit the regulated molecule, IRS1, the regulating molecule, AKT, and then the positive and the negative feedback loop. So there are four distinct classes of therapy that we're working with. So first of all, this is the scenario I'm considering for no treatment, with the one-way switch I just discussed explaining constitutively elevated signaling levels coming down through this motif. So let's consider, first of all, a therapy where we administer an mTOR inhibitor, such as rapamycin. Now, on the face of it, we might think that this is going to be a poor choice because in targeting mTOR, we're going to be further reducing the strength of this negative feedback loop. And remember that the signaling aberration we're dealing with is a relative weakness in the negative feedback loop, which allows this positive feedback loop to dominate. So we might think that's a poor choice. In fact, what we need to bear in mind is that if we were to profile these cells with a protein microarray, then because of these high signaling levels, we would in fact find that mTOR and its signaling associated signaling pathway would be highly activated under these conditions. In fact, we have very good mTOR inhibitors available today, rapamycin and so on. They're being used in clinical trials. They're generally well tolerated, and they do have potent antineoplastic effects in some situations. But you can see here that under the wrong conditions, we can dramatically worsen the situation. Here, in comparison with the no-treatment scenario, we have dramatically elevated, further elevated, these high signaling levels. So this is very undesirable. And this is IRS1 activity I'm looking at here, but of course As a result of these high levels of IRS1, we're going to have very high levels of AKT. And remember that AKT is a very potent pro-survival protein, and having such high levels in the cell is undesirable, and it can make the therapy worse, actually. Make the cancer worse, I should say. And in fact, this phenomenon has been observed in a number of different studies. Here, I'm just going to show you a couple of these. There was a study done a couple of years ago by Dr. Sun and his co-workers, where they treated a whole batch of different cell lines with rapamycin, the mTOR inhibitor. And of course, they did observe a reduction in the activation of the signaling molecules downstream of mTOR, P70S6 kinase and 4ABP1, but unexpectedly, this treatment enormously activated AKT. This is very harmful, actually. It's also been seen in clinical contexts. I'm going to mention a very recent one published in PLOS Medicine a couple months ago, where rapamycin was given to glioblastoma patients. And some patients did well on the rapamycin treatment, but in others, they found that the treatment potently activated AKT. And this was associated with a shorter time to progression. It made the cancer worse, actually, so it's very dangerous. So the point, I guess, I'm trying to make here is that it's not enough to just base a therapy on whether or not a signaling pathway is highly activated. The key is, what are the underlying mechanisms governing this pattern of highly activated signaling molecules? These pathways could be part of compensatory or negative feedback loops, and so treating them with these targeted inhibitors can actually make the disease worse under certain circumstances. Okay, so let's look at some different alternatives now. So now I'm going to look at an IRS1 inhibitor, and you can see here that we preserved the one-way switch phenomenon, but there are a couple of differences now for this case in comparison with the mTOR inhibitor. First of all, we have not elevated or further elevated the signaling levels in the pathway. And in addition, we have enormously increased the critical stimulus level at which this constitutive activation is realized. So in principle, we could prevent the signaling proteins ever attaining these high levels if we were able to push this this point of the curve above physiological levels. However, in practice, because of the one-way nature of this switch, if the signaling molecules were at this high activity state before therapy, they would tend to remain so even with the therapy. So the continued presence of the one-way switch is undesirable, and we should look at other alternatives. Okay, so now I'm looking at an AKT inhibitor. Note that we could achieve this either by inhibiting AKT itself or by inhibiting any of the upstream activators of AKT, such as PI3 kinase or PDK1. And now you can see that we've changed the fundamental control characteristics that we observe and have converted the one-way switch into a two-way switch. So this is very advantageous because now, if signaling levels, if stimulus levels are able to come down low enough, then we can get away from this high level and return to this low activation state. So this is certainly a big improvement, and we can expect that the activation levels will be generally reduced under this scenario. So that's an improvement. Finally, let's look at blocking the association between IRS1 and AKT, so this essentially attenuates the positive feedback loop. And you can see now that because we're targeting the root of the signaling problem here, we have dramatically reduced the signaling levels that are involved here. So we're sort of hovering around the 0.1 level here. Remember, with the mTOR inhibitor, we were at the upper here at about 1. So we're really much lower levels, and you can see, of course, that we've completely removed the one-way switch, so we have a return to a situation where we've got a nice controlled variation in signaling levels with stimulus into the motif. So the key concept I want to introduce you to here is that a protein's suitability as a therapeutic target is determined by the nature of its contribution to the signaling network's control mechanisms rather than by its aberrant activity per se. And this is something that's really overlooked in the cancer treatment field currently. Okay, so to end up, I want to make a few comments about combination therapies now. The idea behind combination therapies is that assuming we know what part of the network is going to be sensitive to treatment, we then want to remove our focus now away from these overarching mechanisms and expand the mechanisms into its molecular participants and target as many of these as possible simultaneously with drugs. And there have been a number of different mathematical models of this combination therapy proposed, and they make a lot of exciting predictions, so I want to share a couple of these with you now. A major prediction, it relates to the ability of these types of therapies to overcome tumor resistance. So let's consider here a model of the EGFR pathway. As I mentioned earlier, in non-small cell lung cancer particularly, there are various key mutations in EGFR, such as this L858R point mutation, which sensitize the cells to apoptosis in the presence of EGFR inhibitors such as gefitinib. So imagine this is the EGFR pathway here. And as I mentioned also, a problem that we face with these therapies is that the tumors ultimately go back, and usually the new tumors have an extra mutation now, a resistance mutation such as this T790M mutation, which inhibits the activity of the drug on the target. So imagine that we have a tumor with this sensitizing mutation, so it's going to respond to gefitinib, say. But imagine also that we have a small clone within this major tumor mass which is already carrying this resistance mutation. So if we just target the receptor with gefitinib, then we can see here at T1 and T4, two different doses, obviously this clone which carries the resistance mutation is not going to respond at all. But if we add one or two more drugs to the treatment strategy at the same time, then you can see that, in fact, we do get significant attenuation even if the drug is not effective at the receptor level. And generally, the more nodes we incorporate and the higher the drug dose, the greater will this attenuation be. So this approach to therapy obviously removes the necessity for each individual drug to be effective at its own target. So that's a key potential benefit of this type of treatment strategy. Beyond that, mathematical models have also made some other predictions of benefits for these types of therapies. So I'm just going to summarize these. So the tumor resistance problem I've mentioned, so in addition, the simultaneous inhibition of a whole cascade of proteins significantly enhances the potency of the therapy. And the corollary to that is that a given level of signaling attenuation may be achieved with significantly lower drug doses. And this is really significant because a big problem with a lot of drugs is that they are too toxic at their therapeutically effective doses, and so they're often discarded. But if we were to use them in combination, then even though they were too toxic by themselves, we can now use them at lower doses and get the same result with multiple drugs. So the thing is, we can bring back into the game a whole lot of drugs which were considered too toxic previously.
Not
thought to be the case. Normally, the therapeutic window, I mean, I'm not quite sure. I'm sorry what you're trying to... So you're saying that because we're adding that many drugs...
The argument made that about the increased efficacy of combination therapy also is an argument, a logical argument, that using lower doses in combination would be just as toxic as using any one of them in high doses.
That's your argument, but, well... Or maybe I articulated incorrectly. I'm trying to say that because we can now use the drugs at lower doses, we reduce the toxicity associated with the treatment because we're using lower doses.
Right, but the pathway is necessary in normal cells, which is the source of the toxicity, then you're going to be interfering with that pathway just as effectively by using three drugs at lower doses and attacking the pathway of three locations as you are using one drug at a high dose and attacking the pathway in one location.
But the signaling network is very different in the tumor cell as compared to the normal cell. So, I mean, that's thought not to be the case. In any event, oh, sorry, yes.
I think that this is a very important and neglected future issue of combination treatment. That it's often assumed that combining these treatments will have differential impact on tumors.
Yeah. Is that right? Okay.
The chemotherapy, the combined modality treatment, has normal tissue effects, just like it has tumor effects. And I think that if manufactured treatment plans that were based on a rational model, then these problems wouldn't, we wouldn't have 10 years of treating kids with combined modality therapy when we find out that it hasn't succeeded.
Okay. Well, I certainly appreciate your insights into this. I mean, I'm not an expert on the drug side of things. My colleagues certainly think that there's potential here. And I guess the only comment I would make is that I'm not talking about... I'm talking more about targeted inhibitors. And, I mean, a toxicity issue we're dealing with here often comes from off-target effects that come when we're using higher doses. So if we can get the doses down... many people believe in the drug discovery field that this is going to lower toxicity. That's my only comment there. And finally, the final benefit that models have predicted is that since signaling networks are highly nonlinear, then generally targeting multiple nodes will have a super additive effect on the downregulation of signaling activity. So we have a synergistic effect, in other words. And so this allows us to have, in a sense, a bonus inhibition that does not come from an extra dose of drug. Okay, I guess I want to leave it there. I mentioned that we have a number of papers on this subject matter. So if any of you were interested, I'd be more than happy to send these to you. Just send me an email, and I'd be delighted to correspond with you. So thank you.
Of the right-hand side of the equation, and we'd like to know if there there's a common agreement. So my question is based on the following remark. Very good, the analysis is very good, very interesting.
Yeah.
But it is based on equations that are commonly agreed, common agreement that you are the right equation for growth.
Okay. Well, I guess we're not strictly tied to any given form of the equation in on some level, because what we're really interested in is the coexistence of both positive and negative regulation. This is a really important motif in cell signaling generally and in cancer in particular. So the point is, generally speaking, regardless of the particular forms of the equation, if we have a nonlinearity coming down to the axis of the motif, then generally we're going to have steady states of multiple steady states. So we're going to have a region of bistability and then a region of monostable steady states. So we could, in principle, construct the model differently, but still we'd be looking at this general cusp catastrophe, let's say. So it's not sensitive. Well, it's not strictly dependent upon the specific forms of the equations that I've chosen. Yes. Oh, sorry.
So you're also assuming the determinant that just deterministic limit works. When you're talking about bistability, if you're in the stochastic regime, you have a rather different system. If you were to go and do this all with Gillespie instead of doing a Michaelis-Menzel type what happens?
I have not included any stochastic stuff. So where is your stochasticity coming into it? Where,
well,
I'm not familiar
with
what you're talking about.
I don't know for this particular molecule, how many copies of this molecule do you have of the receptor? How many receptors do you have?
I couldn't tell you. I need to look at the paper, what kind of concentrations I used for all the signaling participants.
I mean, almost certainly, the real situation is a stochastic situation. The question is, if you're worried about multiplicity or space transition to these kinds of structures, you need to worry about whether the stability diagram is stable when you switch from a deterministic to a stochastic. Something you have to check every time.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not really familiar with what you're bringing to my attention. So.
Schnell.
And Greenland. Sure. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, thank you. Okay. So if we're doing about a combination therapy or just.
So with your very last point.
Yeah. So splitting up the combination rather than giving them at once? I don't know about frequency of dosing, but the idea here is to give all the drugs at once rather than split them up.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. side of things, I'm not, you know, that relates to chemotherapy. I'm not sure how it would work with targeted inhibitors. Yeah, but thank you for bringing that to my attention. I guess we could consider that there are a relatively small number of key mechanisms. Like for example, if the cell needs to be able to, through a given pathway, be able to adapt perfectly, then there are great limitations upon the way that it can achieve that. I mean, it must have, I guess, an integral control mechanism. So I guess one of my points is that the numbers of overall mechanisms that the cell uses are quite limited, even though the particular manifestations are very varied, yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I guess you can have a long rest before saying the talk tomorrow. Anyway, so thank you.